Hello, and welcome back to The Pulse. This is the first Pulse, well, the first proper Pulse since we've come back after the lockdown. My name's Rebecca, and I am joined by Freya and Joe. Today's stories that we are covering, we are starting off with a local story to do with the SU, and basically the SU calling out the university and just generally the government about concerns. We are then going to talk about the lockdown situation, which is taking place today, and the new restrictions that Boris Johnson has introduced. We will then be talking about clubbing with in Nottingham and how basically the lockdowns affected that. And then we will also be talking about ecological catastrophe that has happened to do with some marine animals that have been found on a beach. So we will start off by talking about the situation with the SU. So basically, Sophia Thomas, along with Sam Hawkins, and I think all of the officers have really spoken about this, but basically they've said that they've been working really hard, the whole of the SU, to sort out issues to do with registration failures, changing guidance on welcome events, and just generally not very good well-being for members and staff alike. And they've said that they are taking a formal stance against both the university and the government. They've written an open letter, which you can find online, and basically they've just expressed some real concerns with the way that they're generally having students come back to university following the lockdown and coronavirus has been handled. So I wanted to put to the panel, if you've had a chance to read the letter, what your opinion is on like your experience coming back to university, and whether you feel that like things have sort of worked out in a way that you'd hoped or not.
Coming back to university has been a positive thing overall, but before I came back there was definitely the impression that learning was going to be more blended than it has been. There was sort of the impression that lectures would be online and seminars would be in person. And I think actually what's happened is almost all the teaching for everybody is online. And that's just not the same experience. So I think a lot of people are feeling a bit misled about that. And I think it is brought up in the SU letter. But I don't know what your experience has been.
I agree, Freya. I think there's been a sense that students have been bribed back to the assumption that basically things were as normal last year. Personally, I wasn't under the impression that teaching would be the same as last year. Sort of, I knew this blended form of learning would be quite difficult to adjust to. But I think it's shocking the disparity student to student at their experience. For example, I have about 5 hours on campus a week, which seems to be quite a lot in comparison. I live with someone who takes geography, my course is politics, and she's on campus 5 hours between now and Christmas kind of thing. So it's shocking the disparity between students. But yeah, I think you're right. The student experience is not the same as last year. And I do feel for first year students who aren't getting the experience they're paying for.
Yeah, I have to agree. Like my experience is also, I'm one of the students who basically student services completely messed up, and I tried contacting them and things and they were very unavailable. And I do appreciate the fact that they've had a lot going on with the coronavirus situation. Like I imagine that there's been a lot more issues they've had to deal with, but it's meant basically that I'm incredibly behind on my course already. And I've even started, I've had to be catching up, and it's meant that it's very difficult for me to sort of be able to stay on top of like my work. And as far as the contact hours goes, I've got less than 2 hours a week, so I sort of feel like I don't really need to be here, in the sense of like I don't really need to be paying for additional accommodation, which is quite expensive. But yeah, it's certainly, I feel like, I don't know if you guys agree, but it feels like we weren't really informed what university life would be like when we got back. And even when we did get back, it doesn't feel like people were very prepared. Like I didn't have access to any of my things or anything.
No, I don't think I was contacted by the university at all about coming back until maybe the week before term was due to start. Like, there was just sort of complete radio silence on that front. I've been fairly impressed with how the university has set itself up for sort of social distancing measures on campus, but certainly like the delivery of online material I think is lacking. But I think that's a national problem, not just a Nottingham issue.
Yeah, realistically, lecturers, they've not been trained kind of thing to deliver their content online. You see these things on social media that effectively we're paying for a subscription service like an open university course. But I think I'm sympathetic to the argument that lecturers and the university hasn't done this before either. We're kind of all in the same boat. But I think what was striking about the letter was that, and it's not a criticism, but it was quite abstract in terms of solutions. It's a very difficult line to tread between keeping people safe and delivering a student experience. I don't quite know there's going to be a resolution that's going to satisfy both parties, that the government and the students' union who want to be seen to be providing a good student experience.
No, I agree. I think it's a difficult line to work out what the option is. People, I do feel like from a point of view of like the lecturers, I do feel like they've put in a lot of effort to try and like catch up, lecture engagements and things like this. It has been very inconsistent. I would say like different lecturers do it differently, which is like a bit confusing. But they've put in a lot of work there, and they sort of feel like they're holding up quite a lot of this.
I think so.
Yeah, the staff have been great.
Yeah, but I just it's sort of but I do appreciate that it is difficult, particularly because the university can only work with what is legally allowed, and at the same time they do have costs. Like even if we're not here, they're going to have to still keep up the buildings and maintain those. So it is difficult, particularly also because restrictions come in and go and change. So yeah, it is a very difficult thing to balance, and I do feel like the government maybe possibly hasn't informed them the best. It's also going to be different depending on what area you're in and how your university functions. So yeah,
I think,
sorry, go
sorry.
ahead, Joe.
I think talk of there's been a lot of talk of giving students a refund and stuff, and it kind of goes back to what you were saying, Rebecca, about universities can't survive without our tuition fees, so this is we're stuck between a rock and a hard place. I don't.
Joe, I think you might have dropped out there.
Oh,
I
so
think that's what.
apologies.
No worries.
I
So
think
you're
we're
saying like
can.
between a rock and a hard place. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is very difficult because they do obviously need that. But I mean, I sympathise with students as well because you're not getting like what you paid for per se. But at the same time, it is very difficult for the university's point of view as well. I'm not really sure what the solution is, and I think that's probably why the SU probably doesn't really know what
No.
necessarily to suggest.
I think the emphasis on mental health is important as well, because that's kind of quite a driving factor amongst young people nowadays. So it was good that that was picked out as a particular talking point kind of thing.
Yeah, and both also for the students and the lecturers, because also this is, I imagine, quite stressful for them as well, particularly because they're the ones who have to see quite a few students. I'm not seeing, but they're the ones who like it. I have to speak to like large groups and stuff, which might be a bit different or difficult if you're like you can't isolate yourself in the same way. But with that, we are going to move on, I think, to the next story, which is about the possible restrictions to Nottingham and just generally around the country. So I think that's Freya's story.
Yeah, so Boris Johnson made his speech in the House of Commons today, introducing the three-tiered system, which is going to be brought in to sort of tackle the rise in COVID cases. So it basically splits up into three tiers. So tier one is similar to what we've been seeing before at a national level, where the rule of six is in place, and pubs are closing at 10 and that sort of thing, or what we've been used to. Tier two, which is at higher level of cases, will prevent mixing between different households indoors, but the rule of six applies when outdoors. And then tier three, which is very high level of cases, restricts contact between households indoors and outdoors. And he also brought up the possibility of, you know, pubs and other industries in the hospitality industry having to close. So that's basically what he was talking about in his speech. But I wonder what your guys' take on it was, whether you thought that that was too strict or perhaps not strict enough. I wonder what you think about that.
I think it's simplified to a degree. We had a picture nationally, quite complex local lockdowns. No one was really sure, you know, of the guidelines entirely. But this traffic light system or tiered system, I think, is better. Again, this is the thing that's a difficult position. There will be people. There are two schools of thought. You know, people who want to go back in total national lockdown, and then people who think it's all a waste of time, and we should just open up the economy again. But I think this is quite good in a sense that it manages to tread that line.
Yeah. Rebecca?
Yeah, no, I was gonna say, yeah, I agree. I think that it is a good system in the sense that I think it possibly you can look them up. You know, if you are a tier, etc., you can look up and find out a way of work, because there was all this confusion, like when we had actual lockdown and not just restrictions, like that was like slowly becoming into lockdown, it was very confusing what you could and couldn't do. Like, you could meet people in like a park, but you could only meet one person, but then you could meet the other person like 5 minutes after the other person. Like, it was very confusing. Yeah. You couldn't meet them in your garden, even though that's also outside. So I feel like because we've got this tiered system, it's, you know, very clear, like you're either in that one or you're in this one or you're in that the next one, and then you can look that up and make sure that you're within the guidelines. So perhaps this is a like more effective way of, like a simplified way, like Joe was saying, like of getting the message out.
You go, Joe.
Go ahead, Fran. okay. Nottingham show, I think, if I understand it right, is in tier two.
Yes, really.
Which means that they want to reduce household mixing, but hospitalities and things are still open. But I think maybe it's not local enough, because this is the whole of Nottinghamshire, whereas Nottingham City, I suppose most of the student population do live, is the hot places. Like, I think the border goes out as far as Mansfield and places like that, and there are local leaders saying that it's unfair to be locked down to the same degree as Nottingham City as us when they don't have the rates of transmission. So maybe there is a level that it's not specific enough still.
I think you run the risk, though, if you make it so specific, which is obviously better for tackling cases, but then you end up making it too complicated for anybody to understand. I noticed in Boris Johnson's speeches that sort of at the beginning in March, when we were having national lockdowns, it was very clear what the rules are. And now as we try and sort of navigate our way to a sort of normal, it becomes less and less clear what is and isn't allowed in any different part of the country, which again makes the rules harder to follow and makes them less, I guess, sustainable in the long term.
Yeah, I agree. I think throughout the whole thing, what the government's really been doing is logical, but the messaging isn't quite clear. I think this whole, certainly surrounding students, the blame narrative kind of doesn't help students feel they need to abide by guidelines, because they're going to get blamed anyway, whatever. So I think there needs to be maybe more targeted messaging, not this, if you go out, you're going to kill your nan narrative. That kind of thing is damaging.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, because that was definitely the message that students were receiving from sort of Tory government, and off the back of things like Eat Out to Help Out, where they were specifically encouraged to go and enter the wider community. So
yeah, no, I agree. I do think that they probably do need to change their approach slightly. And also, I do think there's a sort of a valid point that Joe made about like the fact that it doesn't. It is very like student centred, where currently in Nottingham and in, to be fair, lots of different areas of the country where there are sort of like outbreaks. But also, like Frey, you were saying, it's very difficult because, like, what do you do? How do you restrict that? I mean, maybe it would be good if they brought in some kind of restriction just for university. So, like, if you live in university accommodation, like, sort of do something with that. But the problem is if you do that, there's going to be a massive backlash. So it is very difficult to sort of work out how to like, navigate and give solutions. But it seems like an improvement, maybe, with the way that they're messaging. Yeah. And like informing people, but I think they could still like go a bit further and maybe do more specifically targeted messaging and slightly, yeah, less contradictory things. Like, you know, we want people to use the, like, spend money and engage in the economy, but at the same time sending students back to university and then blaming them for a rise is a bit ridiculous, because of course that was going to happen. They all live, I mean, I live in a flat with 12 people. If one of us gets it, like, obviously, that's a
well, that's the thing. I can understand the frustration amongst students, because I think anyone with any sense could have predicted that if you're getting lots of students coming from all over the country and living in houses like you say, Rebecca, with 12 people, it only takes one person and no one necessarily has to get ill.
No.
But that's 12 positive cases, which adds to the figures. And if students are then victimized and more likely to flout the lockdowns, you know, flout the lockdown guidelines, sorry, you do get these spikes. So it's kind of a vicious cycle.
Yeah, it is frustrating from that point of view, particularly when, again, like, we didn't know what was going to happen at university. And I've only got less than 2 hours worth of, is like, in things I actually have to go face to face, so I don't need to be here. And yeah, you know, so it is annoying seeing things on the news like that.
Rebecca, did you not feel a sort of that you had to come back? Certainly from a financial perspective, I know we're paying rent on a flat, you know, those kind of considerations, you'd have to pay that anyway. Is it not better to be in the city? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I wouldn't have to pay for my accommodation, because I wouldn't need to be here per se.
Right, is it like a student flat?
Yeah. So it's like a student one, okay. And I wouldn't have. And I could, like, the way the contract works is that I can, like, basically get out of it.
It's like a lucky position.
Yeah. So like a fortunate position. I do appreciate, like, if you're already were planning to, like, get be in like a house situation, then you're not gonna be able to like necessarily get that back. It depends on your landlord and stuff like that. But I'm glad, sort of, like, I am here and stuff, and it also means I can do stuff with the society, although admittedly we're actually doing it online today. But like, it is good being in Nottingham, but on the other hand, I am paying like a ridiculous amount for accommodation, which I just don't need to be doing. And it also feels frustrating on just a general point of view that, like, if the cases are going to go up this much anyway, and I don't know that we're going to have even more lockdown restrictions, but we like an actual lockdown rather than just restrictions, but we might, and in which case I really don't need to be here. It does just feel a little bit like we've been cheated or misinformed.
And that's why I was surprised. I was talking to a first year about the lack of deferment. Been actually, people haven't deferred the year because they've wanted to come. So that shocked me. I was expecting, once first years who'd applied to come to university had realized that it wasn't quite what they were expecting, they might have thought, oh well, defer to next year. But that doesn't seem to have happened, and I don't know whether we'll see more dropouts this year. I don't know.
I guess travel, like international travel, is largely restricted, and terms of employment, opportunities for employment are also very much down. So people coming out of A-levels might think, well, what else is there for me to
what
do?
Else, what else is there to do?
And go to university and sort of make the best of it. But I don't know. I completely agree with what you're saying, Joe. I think I might have deferred if I was in that situation.
Yeah.
It's sort of hard because on the one hand, I also don't feel like you're missing out too. Like, I know everyone, and I do, I'm not saying that first years aren't missing out on stuff, but like, whilst you're missing out on like the general university experience, I would say like just being able to even just go to lectures, you can't physically do that, and that's like a shame. But as far as like going out is concerned, to be honest, I mean, when I was in first year, people do it during like freshers, but it does peter out, like you're not. And I don't know, maybe this is just my personal perspective, but like I wouldn't have said that. Maybe like if you're only going to university to clubbing, maybe you're going for the wrong reason anyway. So I don't know. I do sympathize though massively with first years, because I also feel like maybe a lot of people didn't know what to expect, so they sort of thought like, well, I should probably go anyway. Yeah. Because I don't necessarily know how it's going to be different or in what way, so sort of you might as well go, I guess. But like Joey was saying, we might see more dropouts as a consequence. So with that, I think we should move on to the next story, which I believe actually is about clubbing. So Joe?
It is, which obviously, as we've said, is a story which will mean a lot to many and not to other people, and not least freshers, who I personally do think are missing out on a taste of Nottingham's nightlife. It's quite a bleak picture there, unfortunately, for nightclubs with no end in sight for when they can open again. Obviously, this is because it's an undeniable fact that clubbing and social distancing are plainly incompatible. We've seen a lot of venues schedule events to the spring and into the summer, but I think one of the main problems, a lot of venues can't afford to put those events on hold any longer, and they've got shortfalls in funding from having to close in March that they need to make up now, which I was quite surprised, actually. They seem to have been, for doubt, the industry have been left behind financial support schemes. So the job support scheme that Rishi Sunak's just announced to sort of replace the furlough scheme mandates that employees must work a third of their normal hours to qualify. And obviously, if nightclub is closed, no one's working any hours. So they've sort of been left there, and that was surprising, because there was an investigation that found that the nighttime economy was the UK's fifth biggest industry and employs 1.3 million people and generates 60% worth of revenue. So yeah, that was shocking that there's such a lack of support there. And also it's led to a sort of rise, not having clubs open has led to this rise in dangerous illegal raves. We've seen an increase in drug deaths at these illegal raves. So it also causes this other social consequence. But it's not all bad. Some venues, especially here in Nottingham, have managed to host socially distanced sit-down events. Stealth and Rock City have put those on. I don't know where we stand now that we're in this tier two lockdown as of Monday afternoon, whether those will continue. And more nationally, pubs in Birmingham adapted to become eating venues. They've hosted events like Britpop brunches. And in June, Nottingham hosted the first socially distanced rave. So that sort of proves that there are solutions in industry that is kind of providing these positive solutions. I just wonder that whether nationally or certainly in kind of damaging city's reputation right out, is there going to need to be another draw for students, other than obviously academic integrity and great teaching content, for next year's freshers? Is there going to need to be another benefit for student life?
I think that as long as clubs can try and find these sort of creative ways to keep their businesses going, it's obviously not going to be the same, but you know, clubbing isn't the be all and end all of being a student. You can have plenty of fun with your friends in the sort of sit down situations we're seeing in places like Rock City. I haven't actually been to an event at Rock City, but I've heard lots of people that have, and they say it's you know, it's okay, it's not the same, but it's perfectly enjoyable. So I don't think it's an end to the sort of student experience, but it certainly is an aspect of student life that is, like you're saying, Joe, can't be replicated, because it's just completely incompatible with any COVID restrictions.
I think people have to, have had to be like a bit more creative when it comes to trying to go out for like a night out, like you're saying, like go to have book a table or have like, or try and do like a more socially distant night out. But it isn't, you know, the same. If you really enjoy going to a really packed club where it's just a completely different experience. But nonetheless, I do think that maybe people could get more out, maybe doing things like societies or something. It's again not the same, but like it's something sociable that you can do and potentially a way to also meet people. But if you are somebody who really likes going out clubbing and like going particularly to sort of like rave-esque sort of clubbing, then it's not going to be the same. But hopefully for the majority of students, they can find some alternative ways. Maybe the university can suggest some more like socials or ways of going out, like if you go for socials at a book a table or something similar. I'm not really sure.
I think it's become such a hallmark of student experience going out, and especially in Nottingham. I think one of the things everyone, when I said, oh, I'm going to Nottingham Uni, oh, it's big drinking, big, you know, great night kind of thing. It wasn't, oh, great teaching quality or anything like that. It was sort of, oh, you're going to have a good night out. And I wonder whether that's just been blown out of the water now. But like, as you say, for students who don't enjoy that lifestyle, it comes as not a relief, but I suppose there's less pressure on having to go out and finding other ways to enjoy your student experience.
I think potentially there might be some issues with like people. It's difficult because I do feel sorry for like the clubs, you know, that aren't able to make money. I don't know how on earth you're supposed to operate like without doing things like tables, because it's just, I don't really see any, like, unless we get a vaccine, there's just like no real soon, like it's right, gonna be the case that they can actually function normally. It's just nothing. There's nothing social distance about it. Have either of you like been out and been to any of the clubs, and what would be your opinions and how they are now?
I haven't been to any clubs during COVID time. I went a fair amount last year when everything was sort of normal, but trying to imagine that experience replicated under COVID restrictions is sort of laughable. But I hope that they can find a sort of middle ground.
I wonder if... No, I've not. A club since March. I have been into to bars and stuff, but, and that's again another curfew of 10 p.m. Which I think, you know, the streets were so busy at 10 p.m. on a Saturday night, everyone's getting chunked out that time, so that's a separate issue. But I wonder that if in the spring next cross or whatever clubs can open, whether people would feel safe, because they're not the most hygienic places in normal times. So is the whole kind of club culture just gonna become underground and you know, completely fragmented? You know, you're not gonna have normal clubs kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a shame. Also, I think the university might have to work out a way to do activities. I mean, I've seen some stuff suggested, like you can do like online, like different like ways of having socials and stuff, but it isn't, I mean, even within socials of like actual societies, normally you would go out potentially as a group to go out to one of the clubs or have a house party, which with the restrictions as they are is not really appropriate, because that's lots of different households all together. So I'm not sure how the university is going to get around that. Hopefully they'll just be able to suggest some other activity. I'm not sure. Also socially distanced ones, but it's not going to be nightlife again for a while.
No, and then where do you make up that? I say it's the UK's fifth biggest industry, and it's £66 billion a year that it contributes to the economy. You know, where does all that money go?
It might be an opportunity for some. So, like, from where I'm from, there's some like alternative bars, which is like where you have an activity, and then they're like it's like a bar. So there's one where you like throw axes and stuff. It's really a strange place, but basically there's like a bunch of different stuff. I think like one of the aisles is like bowling. It's like a really alternative bar, so it's possible we might see a rise of alternative ways to have nights out. So sort of like you still go to a place, but it's just not everybody packed in a room. It's like small groups, and then you all go around socially distanced or something. I don't know. But maybe if it's that big of a part of the industry, and it does concern me with whether that's even going to be supported by the government, even though it's like so much of the economy. I think we're going to move on to the last story, which is about it's also Joe, but you can explain, but it's about some dead animals that have been found on the beach, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's quite a disturbing story, and one that perhaps didn't get the coverage it deserved last week when we were sort of in a COVID Trump blistering news cycle. So, yeah, there were some disturbing reports of what investigators are now calling an ecological disaster, as hundreds of dead sea life were found washed up on a Russian beach in the North Pacific. And apologies for my pronunciation to any Russian listeners, it's terrible. It's the Kalaktyrsky Beach, which is actually a World Heritage Site, popular with tourist surfers who have been reporting symptoms of blurred vision and nausea after spending time in the water. And this led Greenpeace to issue a warning and to raise concern, basically, about a nearby chemical waste dumping ground. And initially, have seemed to pin the blame on it's actually rocket fuel that has been dumped near the beach as the cause of the environment. And I think it feels like a contemporary story at the minute, because we've seen a lot of sort of renewed international focus on preserving biodiversity and preventing a total climate breakdown. But yeah, it's quite a drastic story, which, you know, wasn't covered as well as it could have been, I don't think. Really quite disturbing stuff.
It is, like I said, it does sort of, I think as well, it's like a stark reminder probably to everyone that about like what is going on with big corporations and companies out like in the ocean. And you know, we see things like oil leaks, because what it seems to, I mean, they're doing an investigation, but it looks, it's if they've seen an unusual colour and smell in the water and chemical burns, that suggests that something has possibly spilled in the water, that they've been poisoned rather than it's like just happened. In that case, like, you do have to, like, I am concerned that you hear about like oil leaks all the time and things like that, about like, this is probably a reminder that not to buy certain things and just generally improve how we are, like, in the sense of our sort of our own footprints and stuff, but also that companies are the ones who are causing a lot of real damage here. And in as much as we can make individual changes to our lifestyles, I mean, I remember the whole straw thing from a couple of years ago, it's not really going to make as much of a difference as like an oil leak or a chemical, like a company doing things that are basically either illegal or should be illegal.
Okay, so I think this story brings up sort of two sides to it, which is, one, we're seeing the sort of volatile consequences of climate change and of, you know, people not behaving towards the environment sustainably, and in one sense this story fits into that pattern, but in another sense, like you're saying, Rebecca, is it's big companies being able to cover things up that are sort of out of the ordinary and are big deals or big stories that are being covered up, to which the normal person is sort of powerless to.
Yeah, it's a shame, I think, that it took humans having to report their own symptoms of, you know, rashes, blurred vision, nausea, for action to be taken. Maybe it should have just been enough that hundreds of thousands of sea creatures had washed up for an investigation to be launched. That should have been enough to warrant concern.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's really quite... I think also these are really strange things because we don't really know like the context around the incidents, and I think often they are sort of covered up a bit, like the, you know, because there are a bit strange stories, you do feel sort of powerless to the individual, like informing us that companies are potentially killing loads of wildlife, and there isn't a lot that you know, people just generally can do about that, apart from maybe like stop using their products or whatever it is. Companies that are, who make a lot of money from things like oil or just generally sort of abusing wildlife areas to cut corners and save money, it doesn't feel like you can do all that much. So it is sort of depressing in that sense. And I think maybe that's also why these stories sort of come on the news and then they sort of go. I mean, we had a seal wash up on our beach where I live locally, sort of in Norfolk, and it was, shouldn't have been there, and there's been an investigation and stuff. But like, again, it comes and goes as a story, because it's like it's usually companies that hold a lot of power and influence, and yeah, also there isn't a lot you can individually do, so they just sort of disappear again. But it is very worrying, and I think it's a reminder that of the sort of how things are going in the sense of the environment and how much of it is not in our control, I guess.
Yeah. No, I agree. I watched David Attenborough's documentary the other week. It's what he called his witness statement about the mass extinction of species and protecting biodiversity. And for that hour or whatever, it was like, I'm going to be vegan. I'm going to, you know, do all the recycling. But then a week on, it's kind of, I do feel powerless.
The same patterns.
Yeah, how much does my individual effort really, on the minute scale that I'm doing this, have any effect globally when there are these corporations who, I don't know, it always feels distant and a bit shady kind of thing, are causing all these major global problems. I think, though, in this country, we see things like Extinction Rebellion, and the government is obviously appearing to be sympathetic to those arguments. You know, we've had the wind power by 2030, carbon neutral, etc. So there are things that the government are doing, but they'll always get the criticism that it's not soon enough and it's not enough.
But I think with things like pledges, it's easy to look at pledges by the governments and things, oh, that's great, they're actually taking it seriously. But in reality, it's very easy for a government to make a pledge about something that's going to happen 20 years after the election period's finished. You know, in reality, most governments are only sort of thinking up to the next election cycle. And that's where you have problems of accountability, because in 2050, we're not going to be able to look back and say, oh, Boris, like, you promised us that this was going to happen and it hasn't, because he's going to be sort of long out of power by then. It's sort of the next
person. Yeah, I think that's a good point.
So I think pledges are quite an easy rhetorical device for a politician to use, but rarely make any sort of real difference.
Yeah, I agree, and I also think that often they use pledges as a way of putting the problems onto the people somehow. Like, they'll be like, well, we're going to put in restrictions so that if you have a car in, you know, 10 years time that uses petrol, you have to pay an extortionate fine, which if you can't afford a very expensive electric car, and you have to, that's just going to really cripple you. And I think sometimes, and then they often have to come and amend them and say, well, in this circumstance, like, you know, and change them. And it does feel a bit like they do these dramatic pledges so that when, like, really great things like sort of, you know, Extinction Rebellion does do good work. Some of the stuff has been questionable, but most of their work is really good. And it feels like just a response to that, you know, a very reactionary sort of like way of trying to keep the peace with the issue that has been raised, but ultimately is still sort of pushing the responsibility onto individual people rather than trying to actually come up with some good government initiatives that incentivize people to sort of help out and make it just easier for people rather than harder, I think.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting you say that, Rebecca, about Extinction Rebellion. I wonder, and what you said, Fred, about us looking back 20 years from now, how much this is a problem for young people to tackle. I was surprised when Extinction Rebellion, they blocked the printing press a month or two ago. I asked some of my friends whether they thought that was a successful thing to do, whether that's what groups like this should be doing to raise awareness. And I was really surprised that they weren't quite as radical as I was expecting. I was expecting them to say, oh yeah, it's brilliant, you know, awareness needs to be raised. They were more sympathetic to the argument about freedom of the press and all that kind of thing at the time. So I wonder how much this is I think the media has a tendency to assign certain issues to subsets of the population, and climate is often seen as young people are really interested in this.
Yeah.
Is it something that you agree with?
I think that you've made a good point, Joe, in that when the media sort of assigns climate as an issue for young people, it sort of trivializes it and says, oh, it's not an issue for now, you know, it's an issue that young people care about, when in reality it's really got to be an issue that everybody is caring about right now. You know, it's got to have that sort of immediacy to it, which you don't get when you assign it to just one group or one movement or one facet of the population.
Yeah, particularly as I feel like a lot of the time when young people are the people who are probably doing the most, in the sense that most young people probably use public transport rather than, I mean, not that young people don't have like their own cars and stuff, but a majority of the time, you know, you're getting a lot of buses, trains and things like that. You're not going to work every day in your car that produces a considerable amount of CO2. Like, it's just, I think students do tend to be slightly more careful with the way that they are, like they tend to be slightly more hot on what is a good thing to do environmentally and what's not. So it's almost was a little bit like you're already speaking to the people who were already listening all along, so it doesn't feel as progressive perhaps. So yeah, I don't know, it feels like maybe the government should be doing more, but I don't know how, really. Like, it is easy to, and also there is a practical point that if you put in restrictions that are really unrealistic, people just won't follow them. So you sort of have to work with people and try and incentivize people to do it as well. But it's difficult. If you don't put in actual things that, like, they've put some harsh stuff in for, like, in 10 years' time about, like, restrictions on taxes and increasing, like, a financial, basically, like, sort of penalty if you are using things that are really bad, which on the one hand is really good because otherwise people will just continue to use them. But on the other hand, you know, you shouldn't really have to, like, punish people, particularly when you have situations where there are entire companies leaking stuff into the ocean and killing loads of animals that in real, like, which have nothing to do with anybody, especially not young people. So yeah,
you're penalizing the wrong people in that sense, aren't you?
Like, yeah, definitely.
The ethos should be on, you know, how do we create new technologies that are going to be more sustainable, and how do we look forward rather than how do we sort of penalize the everyday bloke who's just trying to sort of get by with his life, because it's not that person's fault necessarily.
Yeah, exactly. And also, I think also try and give, like, people are not put it all onto the younger generations as well. Like, try and improve stuff now, not only just because it matters, but also because it's not something that the young people should have to inherit. And the more damage we do now, just the bigger that sort of environmental debt will be.
It's a nice hopeful note to end
on. Very hopeful. We've talked about COVID and the environmental situation.
Yeah, what a jolly episode, probably.
Hopefully tomorrow's pulse will be slightly more positive. And in fairness, we have had to get a lot of the COVID stuff out the way because this is like one of the first pulses back since the lockdown. So, yeah. Hopefully,
and I'm already bored of it.
Yeah, hopefully we'll be a little bit more positive for the rest of the week. But yeah, so that's what we have time for really in this pulse today. Make sure to follow us on Twitter, which you can do at the pulse, PulseURN, I think it is. And also follow us on Instagram, URN1350, and Facebook. We tweet about like any breaking news, and also just tell you what the story is going to be for the day. So yeah, that's all we have time for, and see you tomorrow then.